At this time, I have the honor to present to you the moral leader of our nation. I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. So we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protests to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is tied up with our destiny. And they have come to realize that their freedom is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. And as we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our bodies, heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We can never be satisfied as long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity by signs stating for whites only. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution. Yes. And staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities. Knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. Dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee." Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrims' pride. From every mountainside, Let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Well, hi, everybody. I'm Beattie Cohn-Vredos, and welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beattie Show. As you all know, I'm a psychotherapist and sex therapist and author. But today, instead of talking about our own individual issues, our depression, our anxiety, our substance abuse, we need to really think about others. We need to really think about what is going on in America. And of course, I have a dream speech that was given by Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. It's a speech that should not just be played once a year on January the 16th. It's something that we really need to be thinking about every single day. How well we are doing in terms of helping the cause, helping to bring people together, helping to really diminish racism in America, and not just talk about it, but the real issue, of course, whether or not we're dealing with our own issues or not, is what are we prepared to do? And what action are we taking? Have we taken? And perhaps we haven't taken any action in the past, but thinking about moving forward, what are you doing? What are we doing every single day to help improve race relations? You know, in preparing for today's show, I happened to read some research from the Pew Research Center, and I want to share some facts about what is really going on in America in the African American communities. Because Black Americans, they have a clear vision for reducing racism. But unfortunately, and this is repeated over and over again in research, but have little hope that it will happen. And many say that key United States institutions should be rebuilt to ensure fair treatment. You know, after George Floyd's murder, half of Americans, and again, this is the Pew Institute research, half of Black Americans expected policy changes to address racial inequality. But by 2021, many did not see improvements to Black people's lives and did not expect it. More than a year after the murder of George Floyd and the national protest and debate and the political promises that ensued, 65% of Black Americans say the increased national attention on racial inequality has not led to changes that improve their lives. And 44% say equality for Black people in the United States is not likely to be achieved, according to newly released findings from an October 2021 survey of Black Americans by the Pew Research Center. And this is somewhat of a reversal in views from September 2020, when half of Black adults said that the increased national focus on issues of race would lead some major policy changes to address racial inequality in the country, and 56 expected changes or hoped the changes would make their lives better. And at the same time, many Black Americans are concerned about racial discrimination and its impact. And roughly 8 in 10 say that they have personally experienced discrimination because of their race or ethnicity. And that is a whooping 79%. And most say that discrimination is the main reason many Black people cannot get ahead. And even so, Black Americans have a clear vision for how to achieve change when it comes to racial inequality. And this includes support for significant reforms to or complete overhauls of several U.S. institutions to ensure fair treatment, particularly the criminal justice system, political engagement, primarily in the form of voting, support for Black businesses to advance Black communities, and reparations, yes, reparations in the forms of educational, business, and home ownership assistance. Yet alongside their assessments of inequality and ideas about progress exists pessimism about whether U.S. society and its institution will change in ways that would reduce racism in America. Well, I have a guest today, my husband, the love of my life, Jim Freddos, who is a sociologist, a criminologist, an activist, and the host of the Radical Imagination television show on M&M. So, Jim,
yes,
have we come? What kind of progress have we really made at the grassroots level?
Well, you raise, of course, some really profound thoughts in that powerful speech that we heard was one of hope. But I want to introduce another work of King's, and that was his last work, his last book. Before his assassination in 1968, it was called Where Do We Go From Here? I think that's the question you're asking, Beattie. And that was the title of the book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community. So that's an interesting way he puts it. I think I'd like to just start our discussion on this by pointing out, although you did mention certainly about significant reforms that not only, you know, Black people have advocated, but increasingly more and more white people, young people, older people, working people, and so on, are beginning to realize that there are some deep, deep structural, institutional, moral, political, economic issues that are bedeviling America. They certainly, that was true that when King pointed out, and even more so now. And I want to say certainly there has been some progress, but there also has been, for example, a greater inequality of wealth. And I want to emphasize to your audience too that King wasn't a doctrinaire Marxist or doctrinaire socialist, but he was a progressive. He identified as a social democrat, and he advocated in this last book a guaranteed annual income. So he was advocating a broad-based social movement of all peoples that would act within both the Republican and Democratic parties. Of course, that's increasingly difficult the way the Republicans have gone, but also the Democrats have to go beyond their neoliberal perspective. So King was definitely a voice, had a vision that transcended the great, great majority of political leaders that we have. And I certainly think he would have been within the Bernie Sanders camp, the AOC camp. And again, the signature law that he would be advocating is some form of guaranteed annual income. And that in itself would have reduced the ethnic and racial friction between peoples who are pitted against each other, particularly in the South, but across the country. So let me just start by saying that.
Well, let me just say that it's not just Blacks who would benefit from a guaranteed income as a Canadian. I mean, this is one of the things that has helped Canadians, I think, prosper and be able to live because of the guaranteed annual income and pensions that Canadians and all Canadians get, whether or not you've worked or you haven't worked. So this is not just about Blacks.
Oh, super great point.
And one of the things, too, I think a lot of people will say, well, look at on television. We see all these Black faces. There are all these people now on the news, and they're doing commentary. And what do you say to that? Because we know that that's a very, very minute, small percentage of people.
Even the percentage, that's not the important issue in a way. Black or white, in the mass media, that the narrative that is being spelled out is one that King would have pointed out, and Reverend William Barber, the Poor People's Campaign, points out continuously, is a narrative that perpetuates violence, militarism, as King pointed out. The greatest perpetrator of violence in the history of the world has been the United States. We have over 800 military bases. We spend well over $1 trillion on military. We supply more military armaments around the world than all than 15 of the next countries put together. So we are following a narrative that is intrinsically unfair. We now have a situation where wealth is concentrated in fewer and fewer hands than it ever has been. So in that sense, we've regressed from what King has been talking about. Has there been some progress? Certainly there has. Civil rights movement, the Black Lives Movement has made great strides, but also you find pushback. And last point I'll make on this is that it's very hard, as you know, as a psychotherapist, to get an individual to come to grips with some of their deep-seated behaviors that have gotten them in trouble in the past. And we as a culture, I'm not painting a horribly blanket picture of America's the great Satan of the world. No. But I am saying, you know, we have made a tremendous amount of money. The country has gotten richer off the backs of unpaid slave labor and Jim Crow work. So we've got to get to that point. And I think that's individually and collectively come to the point where we are willing to realize certain truths. We haven't gotten there yet. And I think voices like King and Reverend Barber and Cornel West and others, and white progressives as well, have to double down on that narrative. So yes, there are more Black faces here and there and so on, but we need to have a stronger narrative from all about what America is truly about.
Well, I want our listeners to know that Jim and I are in Sarasota, Florida right now, and I'd actually reached out to a number of African-American groups here, but because today is Martin Luther King's birthday, people are very engaged. But what I'm planning to do in the next month is to actually talk to African Americans who live in Sarasota, because I am curious, as someone who once lived in Sarasota, what is actually happening here in Sarasota, which has traditionally been a very, very white city. But I want to comment, Jim, on some of the other research findings from the Pew Institute. For example, Black Americans see racism in our laws as a big problem and discrimination as a roadblock to progress. So laws also, it's not just enough for individuals to be more conscious of how we treat other people, but you know, we're talking about a lot of changes that need to happen in our laws. And for example, 6 in 10 Black adults say that racism and police brutality are extremely big problems for Black people in the United States today.
Well, Again, I think the data speaks for itself. This is not some tirade against the police, but the police have also been put in a position by economic and political elites. That was the first job, if you will, that police were asked when the first police forces were developed in the East Coast and Boston, Philadelphia, and New York, and so on. And that was to break up labor strikes. They have invariably been put in position to go after so-called crimes of the working class, of the poor, of the working poor, etc. And they're trained that way within the academy that they are educated in, and so on. So these laws, for example, vagrancy laws, this goes way, way back, where if a black person was caught on the quote unquote wrong side of town, it was the police that would get them out of there and arrest them and have all sorts of. Now that again, that was institutionalized in the law, and you had courts that followed those laws and put many black people and others, of course, away for that. So we're talking about a narrative that again exploits especially poor working class people and so on.
And I think that we have to speak to black Americans themselves. And I think it's one thing, you know, for research to be commenting on the state of affairs, and for white people to be commenting on what we think and what we feel. But again, in looking at this data, we're finding that the majority of black Americans say that racism, 63%, police brutality, 60%, economic inequality, 54%. And also 9 in 10 black adults say that multiple aspects of the criminal justice system also need some kind of change to ensure fair treatment, with nearly all saying so about policing, 95%, the courts and the judicial system, 95%, and the prison system, 94%.
If I may, almost all the rioting, the so-called civil disorders that you've had in our history was initiated because of some sort of police action. So that's telling you right there, this is nothing new. This has been going on for a long while. And the reforms that are needed are have to be much more extensive than just having a more diverse police force, because black police officers can be tougher on their own people and so on. So the whole idea of punishment, of going after people and not addressing, as King would, the underlying reasons why people turn to destructive and self-destructive behavior, which we need to address with funding for education and housing, as you mentioned, for counseling, humane reasons that could give people a decent opportunity in life and make them less enraged about what the system is doing to them.
Absolutely. And another thing that we really, really do have to focus is voting. The whole issue of buying black viewed as important strategies for black community advancement. Now, you are more of an expert when it comes to the voting issue than what has been the problem with these boundaries?
Barber is really the expert, right? They've done a really wonderful research on voter repression.
Yes.
And suppression.
Can you speak to that?
Yeah, well, it's again, the powers that be want to maintain their power and are threatened by the idea of more democracy. And that's what we're supposedly about. That is greater participation by more people in our democracy. That's by definition, that's what a democracy is about. So the people who are opposing or making it harder to come by to vote and create all these this craziness about bogus elections and so on, have an agenda, and that is something that they really haven't dealt with. And it's not just in the Republican Party, but it seems to be festering there more so than in the Democratic Party. They want to maintain power, and they know very well with the message that they're presently commenting on and presenting that they can't win. The majority of people, they're scared when blacks and whites and Latinos and others join together and hear that fusion message that Barber is so incredibly adept at presenting. That's what they don't want to have happen. And that's exactly what we do need to happen. And we will have much more of a progressive agenda, progressive voices, when in fact that happens. Mm-hmm. And when it's expressed in electoral politics as well.
Mm-hmm. So that people really need to understand, both blacks and whites, the importance of voting and trying to make sure that whether or not you're voting after work or that you find a way to elect people who would be able to support.
How do they do it in Canada? I mean, do you have a system where, you know, early voting, are you, do you have a holiday celebration? most of Western democracies want more people to participate. We, our elements within our culture, don't want it. And again, you have to bring this out. I mean, King, again, as I said, wasn't a doctrinaire Marxist. He wasn't a doctrinaire socialist. But there's no question that the voices that are leading the charge, especially in the Republican Party, but they're in the Democratic Party too, are the multi-billionaires who have a stake in keeping people at each other's throats and don't want the progressive agenda. It's just simply that. They don't want a national health insurance. They want a guaranteed annual income. They don't want to lift people up above the poverty rates. And again, as King tried to do in that great speech you pointed out, and as Barber does over and over again, where are these resources? They're going in incredibly harsh and harmful, brutal ways into wars, unnecessary wars, and into our prison system, mm-hmm. And so on.
And let's not forget to mention healthcare.
Absolutely.
Going on in our healthcare system, which is so clearly broken, not just for blacks.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, but also for middle class and lower middle class whites. I mean, the insurance plans are prohibitive. And what I'm finding, Jim, even with some of my own doctors, they have opted out of taking Medicare. They've opted out of insurance plans. And
they're overworked at the hospitals. They're getting, the pandemic has played havoc. It's just atrocious.
But the consumer is paying the price. The consumer is paying the price when you are not able to go to see a doctor, where you have to wait weeks and sometimes months. And then if you don't have the right insurance,
forget it.
You are really, really left to your own devices.
And if you don't pay your bill, you're in debt. And that's a major, I think, the number one reason people are in debt in this country is because they owe medical bills.
And if you don't happen to be fortunate enough to see a physician, the reality is you might very well die.
Yeah.
We need to really, just reinforce the reality of
that. That's structural violence.
That's structural violence.
250,000 people alone in New York City die of that, disproportionately black and Hispanic.
You see, the concept of structural violence is something that, of course, you've taught me, is something that I think that most people really don't either think about or don't really understand, because people will say, well, African-Americans are no longer being lynched. But as you and I have been talking, they are being lynched, and poor people are being lynched by the system.
You can relate, and I've done this already in the few days you've been in Sarasota. You talk to the white middle class, the more moderate, they know they're getting screwed as well. And yet they've been taught that if somehow it's Blacks fault because they're not able to keep up with the wages or make enough money. But they are not stupid about this. They realize that they are also severely damaged by the system as it is. But what you have is these demagogue politicians who pit them against each other. And that's, again, what we need to overcome, as you're pointing out, white and black together, as King was trying to say.
Now, something else that I thought that was a very interesting finding from the Pew Research is that most Black Americans support repayment for slavery. And what that means is that the legacy of slavery affects the position of Black people in the United States. They say either a great deal, 55%, or a fair amount, 30%. And Black adults who say descendants of the enslaved should be repaid support, doing so in different ways. About 8 in 10 say repayment in the form of educational scholarships, 80%, financial assistance for starting or improving a business, and financial assistance for buying or remodeling a house would be extremely or very helpful.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, if you have millions of people working for you in this country for no wages at all, slave labor and so on, you're going to be very, very rich off those people. And we haven't even said we're sorry about that. No, I think the whole idea of reparations, I'm certainly not an expert on that, but I think that it's well past due. And we've had reparations in this country. It's been largely for white people, though. The Homestead Act in the 1840s and so on, 1800s, mid-1800s, was directly grants given to basically white peasants, ethnic white peasants who came over as immigrants and were given, I think it was 160 acres of land and so on. Now, I think, you know, what you're reading there is right. I think what you're going to hopefully have at least is acknowledgement of that slavery, but it would be reparations in the form of education or housing that would benefit millions of other people as well. It's not about white people today somehow taking money from them and paying black people today who they never enslaved. We've got to go beyond that. That's not the game. That's not what we're trying to get at there. We need to institutionalize and structure a fair policy. Some groups have had it certainly more disproportionately. The system has been more disproportionately directed against them. But other ethnic groups, white ethnics and so on, certainly indigenous peoples, have experienced some of the same things, maybe not to the degree, certainly indigenous people have, but many of the white ethnics have also experienced a great amount of discrimination and been exploited. So I think when you talk about reparations, I mean, for Pete's sakes, if Germany can do it for what happened during the Holocaust, we can certainly enter into our humane voices here in this country and seek to create a more equitable, just world. And that's the last point I want to make on that is, it's not when, as Christ would say, you know, that we help the least among us. It's not just helping the least. It's all of us. It gets us out of our own destructive pattern of economic and moral exploitation.
I think we get so caught up, Jim, in our own narcissism, in our own day-to-day life, our own struggles, our mental health struggles, our substance abuse struggles, our relationship struggles, our physical struggles, that we don't tend to really think too much if at all, about any of this. And, you know, on our trip here to Sarasota, I happened to find an article, and I was not able to reach the reporter. But this article, this was in the Herald Tribune, which is the newspaper in Sarasota, written by Carrie Steinman, and the headline, "If you were Black, would you want to live in Sarasota?" And of course, this is exactly what I was wanting to interview some African-Americans about, which I will do in the coming weeks. But this is really interesting. And this is a 2020 story. So we'll have to see whether or not anything has really changed. But at the Sarasota Herald Tribune, the news staff, for example, 89% white. The management ranks more than 90% male, so hopefully they've made some changes in the last couple of years. And in actual headcount, this means just 3 non-white employees, but none were Black, so maybe Hispanic. I'm not sure what the non-white employees were. And among our 30 newsroom staffers and of 11 managers, there was just one female. So what Carrie Seidman is saying, she said that there hasn't been a Black newsroom employee during her 10 years at the Herald Tribune, and the last one left in 2008 at the beginning of the Great Recession as newsrooms were pummeled with layoffs, and no one at the paper now has ever had a Black manager here. And this is what she was saying. A former publisher, Diane McFarland, made many attempts to recruit Black managers, but they just didn't want to come to Sarasota. So I am very, very curious in finding out what life is like here for, I mean, there are a lot of rich people. There are communities, there are Black communities here that are very poor, just to really find out what is going on. Because when I lived here, it was a very, very segregated world. The whites lived in one world, the Blacks lived in another world, and very, very rarely did people come together. So this has been 8 years since I left Sarasota. Again, very, very curious to find out what is going on in a pretty white-looking city, right?
Well, I mean, I think that's probably true across the country, across the South. I mean, it's a pretty community. It's by the water. It's nice weather and so on.
Very expensive.
Well, yeah, as a resort town, and that of course creates an environment where fewer and fewer minorities can make it, and that's true of a lot of exclusive resort areas in the country. What I was going to get at is, you know, King often, and as Barbara does too, refers to the Hebrew scriptures, and in the speech, you know, you just presented, we will, you know, get to the promised land. May not get there with you, but we will get there as a people. What I want to get across is that Blacks and Jews, for that matter, and other groups, but in particular, see their struggles not so much in individual terms, but as a people. We will get to the promised land. Now, that meant Jews escaping their slavery in Egypt. How many years ago? You're the resident. So thousands of years ago. And that was what King was trying to make clear. We've got to start thinking, make the narrative into one where we really, truly begin to care for each other and create a more humane vision where it's not just, oh, well, we now have 20% Blacks and on the new staff. It's more than that. It's creating an environment, a narrative where the collective groups of people are making it. And so we got to get out of this measurement of, well, we had a Black president. Well, that's the end of no more racism. Oh, we still need to have a Jewish president or a female. Well, yes, we do. But guess what? If that black president, a Jewish president, a woman president is, talking about the same policies that the whites, the majority of white presidents have.
All that's changed is
the face.
I mean, exactly. That's it.
Yeah.
Another really interesting and I think disturbing finding from the Pew Research is that Black Democrats and Republicans differ on assessment of inequality and visions for social change. Do you want to speak to that?
Well, yeah, different. One other thing to say here is, and I respect that a lot, and I really am very much in favor of individual rights and individual freedoms that we have in this country. That's so much of the, I don't want to live under some sort of totalitarian, authoritarian regime. I want as much democracy as possible. I want as much of an opportunity for individuals and collectivities to manifest their creativity and to be what they really want to be. But I think too much we think of economic mobility in individual terms. And I think we've got to get away from that, and that there's no question the data, you can't hide from the fact that inequality is greater today than any other time in our history. So whether we're Democrats, Republicans, it's concentrating fewer and fewer hands. And that doesn't create a very good functioning society at any level.
For sure. But for example, again, according to the Pew Research findings, when summarizing the nature of racism against Black people in the United States, the majority of Black Republicans, 59%, say racist acts committed by individual people is a bigger problem for Black people than racism in our laws. And Black Republicans, 45%, are also more likely than Black Democrats, 21%, to say that Black people who cannot get ahead in the United States are mostly responsible for their own condition.
And I would guess that most of these Black Republicans have made it, and that's not putting down their efforts, through often great struggles. But the other point to point out is that, in terms of, Black voting and Black numbers in the Democratic Party versus Republican, you can't compare the two. What do we have? Rates of 80-90% support by Blacks for Democratic policies and so on. In fact, identifying more as progressives, as do American Jews still generally. So, look, there's no question. If you're going to create an environment where people are ghettoized and segregated and pitted against each other and have an economic and political system where they're an educational system where it's very, very difficult, not that some don't make it, but great masses do not make it. And you have a police force that's constantly harassing and hassling and so on. And what you've done is create an environment where, yes, Blacks are praying, but they are put in an environment where they're taking out a lot of displacement and rage and so on their own people. Again, what King is saying is we have to desegregate the country. We have to desegregate Sarasota, our educational system. It's not just for the elites. It's not for those who can afford $100,000 a year to go to Yale and Harvard and so on. And that means really, really radical transformation in the way we do business and run educational systems and all sorts of things, news outlets and so on and so on. So what King was talking about is a revolution in a sense, and let's not mince words. He was really talking about a radical transformation of American society. It's Barbara's trying to carry on that tradition. I think, as you pointed out, each of us can do it in our own way, and even if it's just a humane reaching out to people who we ordinarily wouldn't do. It's not just about giving charity or, you know, giving poor people a turkey every Thanksgiving. As you were saying, find out what people are thinking. Find out what they're concerned about. Because you know what? Much of the same things that they're concerned about, you're going to be concerned about as well.
No, absolutely. But, you know, in one word, Jim, it really comes down to radical love. And it's about caring. It's about sharing. It is about being concerned for our society. It's about being concerned for our fellow man, whether or not the person is rich or poor or Jewish or Christian or Muslim or gay or straight or trans. We have to become more of a caring society.
I'm so glad you brought that up toward the end of our dialogue, because that's what King ended the speech on.
Right.
He dreams of that sort of day and of radical love, and where it doesn't, the color of your skin doesn't play a part, your religion, so on. It's a universal, transformative, radical love. It goes beyond nation, clan, family. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because you're right in line with what King was saying.
Well, I've been a good student of yours. Well, I mean, this is something.
You're from Canada, so you are.
We talk about.
Got a head start on that.
And of course, you know, Canadian society is hardly a perfect society, but, you know, we don't worry about health care. We don't worry about guaranteed annual income. I mean, we are a gentler, kinder society, which I'm hoping that in the not too distant future that the United States can become.
Amen.
With just a couple of more minutes left, I like to, first of all, thank you so much, everyone, for listening. I know it's a very different Ask Beatty show. We don't, today we didn't talk about depression and sexual issues and
well, we did in certain ways. We did.
Well, I guess we did. I guess
yeah,
we did.
Breakup of families through economic hardship.
Well,
and racism,
that we did.
Putting people in prison. So, yeah.
We talked about structural violence, which, of course, affects the individual and families and our mental health and our relationships and our sex life. But again, I want to thank you all so much for listening, as you do every single week, Mondays from 3 to 4 p.m. here on the Progressive Radio Network. And I want to leave you with my two weekly messages. And, of course, the first message, whether or not you're wanting to have a better society, a better life, a better relationship, is to make sure that you do everything possible to love yourself and to live your life in ways that are really, really in your best interest. And secondly, we all need to do a much, much, much better job in learning to love each other.
I just wanted to say one. Thank you so very much for inviting me again to the show. King himself, before he wrote this book, was in a long period of isolation and depression. He wrestled with these issues as nobody else did in that time. Well, and he got out of that depression through action and through this powerful book. Where do we go from here?
Yeah.
Chaos or community? And that's what you do every week, Beatty. You set the standard for individual health and community health. So,
well, I certainly try. I try with my patients. And of course, everybody knows that I have a private practice in New York City and also in East Hampton. You can also contact me. All you need to do is go to my beattycohn.com website. And there is all of my contact information. So again, I want to thank you so much for listening today. And I really, really hope that you've been able to take in some of the things that Jim and I have been talking about. Because, you know, in the final analysis, all of this really does matter. So goodbye, everybody. And what the world needs now is love, sweet love.
Keep the dream alive.